Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 94.7 WPVC LP Charlottesville. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And thank you so much for being here with us today. Our guest today, Jordy Yeager. Jordy, good morning.
Good morning, Rick.
The first Sunday in February.
That's right.
We're going to be talking about a recent article that Jordy wrote on gentrification in Charlottesville. 10th and Page. Jordy, I think before we get started, one of the things that people know is I am going to repeat this word throughout the hour is, can you define gentrification?
I can. It's probably not the actual definition, so somebody would definitely need to fact check this.
No calling in.
Right. But it's basically when a neighborhood shifts in economic and income status. And generally, it is used to describe a shift from the lower economic stratosphere to an upper economic stratosphere. And what people have come to associate with gentrification is a cultural shift that often occurs as well, where those lower income folks that have lived in that neighborhood for a long time tend to be forced out for a variety of reasons, whether it's affordability or a cultural shift that doesn't agree with their culture. And so the neighborhood turns over into a new economic stratosphere and then also a new cultural sphere as well.
So we're talking about 10th Street and Page in Charlottesville. For those folks who are going, where is that?
It is right in the heart of Charlottesville. Cordoned off on four sides by some different familiar landmarks. And so to the south is West Main Street. And so if you were to imagine the new giant behemoth apartment buildings, the student apartment buildings, the flats, the uncommon, the standard that are going up right now, that's to the south. And on the other side, the north side, it's bordered by Preston. And so you have Martin's Hardware. You have what it used to be the old dairy building that's since been retrofitted. I think Harvest Moon Catering was there for a while. There's some different businesses. Back in my era, there was a paintball arena down there. To the east, you have the railroad line. And so that runs through Charlottesville, and that kind of cuts the neighborhood off. And we can talk a little bit more about some of that because it used to actually be connected all the way to downtown through through streets, and those have since been cut off as well. But to the west is it's open to interpretation where the actual border of the neighborhood tends to, you know, the city says one thing, school districts say another thing, but generally speaking, most people agree that it's around 13th Street that it ends, and so that's right by Venable Elementary School.
All right. So, but in terms of gentrification in your part, and you say lower income, we're talking about African American.
It's one of the largest remaining African American neighborhoods. It, of course, wasn't always that way. But for a long period going on, upwards of 100 years, it's had a large African American presence, and increasingly in those last 100 years, a low degree of white people have lived there, not exclusively, but it's the largest continual African-American neighborhood in Charlottesville.
And you're writing this article, or you're researching this article in 2017?
Correct, right.
So would you have written this article 10 years ago? Would you have researched this article 10 years ago? Right now you're a 30-year-old white male wandering the streets of 10th and Page, and you're knocking on doors and asking people to talk. But would you have done this as a 30-year-old white male? Would you have done this 10 years ago in this neighborhood?
Sure, sure. Well, so I grew up in Charlottesville, and so I know a lot of folks that live in 10th and Page. And so a lot of this story was spurred by anecdotes that they would share with me of things that they saw out their front door of the neighborhood being, of shifting, of the neighborhood shifting in front of their faces. And feeling as though their voice was not being heard as part of the greater politics, of the greater dynamics, the developers, the city that were shaping and molding the future of the neighborhood. And it does have a long history there. And so there's many different things that have happened over the decades. But I would say 10 years ago, I think was about the start of this gentrification process. It may date a little bit further back, maybe 13, 14 years ago. But there was definitely a change afoot. I think now in 2017, that there's definitely more. You can see where things settled as far, you know, while that change was happening during that time, it wasn't sure where it was going in what direction. And now you're able to see kind of where that foot dropped and see the writing on the wall for the future a little bit more clearly as a result as well. But by my being white, I don't think that is prohibitive in so much as I have relationships with a lot of the families there. That it pre-exists just this article that go back to my childhood. I went to Burnley Moran with a lot of the kids there. So
now I'm familiar with the area. I lived on Wortland Street. That's just outside of the area that we're talking about. But I spent 10 years on Commerce Street, which is inside of the train tracks that we're talking about. So I'm curious... You talk about the city facing a housing crisis, and that sort of leading to why part of this takes place, why part of the gentrification takes place. Is this because there are more students and the houses are, the neighborhood becomes gentrified? Is this because there are two home owners that need two homes or want two homes? Talk about that.
Sure. Yeah. No, it's a variety of reasons. And so there's no one thing, but I think a lot of people are moving to Charlottesville. I think that's the first and foremost thing. And so it's not, you know, my generation, or I'm 36. And so it's not this generation getting of age and buying homes necessarily that grew up here, but it is a lot of, the 30, 40 year old crowd that is moving here, and wanting to buy something that's affordable. And when you look around Charlottesville, the housing stock, is pretty constrained, right? We're 10 square miles in the city. And so if you do want to be in the city limits, then you have a limited choice because there's just not availability of houses. There's not a lot of vacant houses. There's not houses that are for sale. And so that's number one of what houses are available. And then number two is what's affordable. And there was a housing study that the city commissioned a couple years ago that basically looked at all of the different income brackets of homeowners and home buyers. And what they found was, I mean, they found many things, but one thing that stuck out to me was that the very wealthy, the folks that make upwards close to $1 million or slightly less, 700,000 and above, that they can afford a certain house in terms of price, but that they are buying houses that are far cheaper. And that is because there aren't houses that satisfy that $700,000 a year income bracket. So as a result, they buy houses that they can amply afford, and that they that really, when looking at, you know, income and house price and affordability, that those houses that high income bracket are buying really would be affordable for a slightly lower income bracket. And so as a result, you have this trickle down effect where you have that slightly lower income bracket, the people that make $400,000, say, that are buying houses that the $200,000 crowd can afford, and so on and so forth, until you get to that lower echelon of below $100,000, which I think there are a good number of folks, but that they don't have very many options left. And so they're buying the houses that traditionally folks that making under $50,000 a year might be able to afford. And so then looking at the neighborhoods of where those houses exist, Belmont as you probably know, it was one of the first neighborhoods to turn over. It had some of those houses that were $150,000, $200,000 that you could fix up. And a lot of people did, and they did what's called flipping them. And so they fixed them up. They put a new coat of paint on, maybe a new roof, and fixed up the yard, and then sold them for $300,000, $400,000. But that all happened, right? That's come and gone. You'd be lucky to find a house in Belmont in that price range now. In that $200,000 price range. And so that is starting to play out throughout the city. And the next neighborhood, as Belmont was happening, I think Fifeville was happening as well. You know, it may give or take a year or two, depending on time. But the same sort of thing happened in Fifeville. Houses got bought at low rates and then fixed up, rehabbed, and sold for twice as much. And that's generally what's happening in 10th and Page. Not exclusively, there are several other factors at play. There's a large rental market that's been frozen at an affordable level by a guy named Jeremy Kaplan. Eugene Williams had a bunch of homes there that he stabilized in terms of rent. It's also got a public housing neighborhood there. So it's a variety of things at play, but you definitely do have UVA professionals, so a lot of medical staff buy homes in that neighborhood. You have some folks in the private sector, some folks in nonprofit sectors. You do have I think second home buyers, though they're, from what I found in looking at property records, those aren't the majority of folks. They do exist, but
is it just the fact that you knew some of these folks from going to school with them that prompted you to write this article?
Not necessarily. No, I think housing is the crux of most every racial disparity in Charlottesville and probably in most major cities, but definitely in Charlottesville because it dictates so much. Everything from your wealth, your family's income, your interaction with social services, with the law, with the legal system, your education levels are directly correlated to what neighborhoods you live in. Infant mortality rates, your healthcare, your diabetes, hypertension, it's all correlated to neighborhoods. Every juncture of life is dictated by where you live. If you look at income mobility and whether you're able to rise out of poverty into upper income levels, the number one component is where you live, is your environment. And so when looking at all of these things that we're concerned with now, of why are there racial disparities across the board in Charlottesville, I think housing has to be first and foremost on that conversation because it's historically led to these disparities, right? We didn't just wake up in this bubble, and it's not something that we're going to solve just by dealing with what's in front of us. We have to look into the past and say, how did we get here? Why are we here? It was a series of decisions that some of which were very deliberate and that I don't know, myself included. I definitely didn't learn about this coming through the public school system, but I don't know very many people in the city who have a really thorough breadth of knowledge of how all of these components historically have played a part in creating our present day reality.
Sunday morning wake up call. Our guest today, Jordy Yeager, the journalist we're talking about, his article in the Seva Weekly, longtime 10th and Page residents seeing a shift in the neighborhood. You can find it back in the in early December issue of the Seva Weekly, c-ville.com. Talk about a 2016 report by Lesser and Company that you did some research on. Did you see the Orange Dot Project report as well? You find poverty in neighborhoods in this report. Can you talk about that a little bit in your research and writing this article?
Sure. So, yeah, for folks that aren't familiar, the Orange Dot Report was a project done by Ridge Schuyler, and he basically looked at census data and boiled it down to the nuts and bolts of how much are people earning and where do they live. What neighborhoods, and mapped it, and to get a real sense of where poverty exists, and then he did something which was really unique, and that is he quantified how much it actually takes to survive in Charlottesville. So what is the actual cost of gas? What is the actual cost of childcare? What is the actual cost of an electric bill? Not just what do the federal poverty guidelines say, but what is the reality? And the reality is that it costs far more than what the federal government says to live here in Charlottesville, just because cost of living is very high. So he put, roughly speaking, I think it was $35,000 is what it takes to be self-sustaining. That means be able to afford your food, you know, have no sort of assistance at any level. And that's with, I think, two children. And then he quantified, based on the census data, how many people make less than that. And it was approaching 25%, so about a quarter of our population. Those numbers, I forget, I'd have to go back through notes and research, but how that breaks down in terms of African-American percentage. But I do know that it's not proportional, so that the percentage of African-Americans who are in poverty in Charlottesville is not proportional to the percentage of African-Americans in the total population.
And then he broke it down by neighborhood as well, correct? And so you can identify which neighborhoods received green and which neighborhoods received orange. And, of course, 10th and Page and others received orange dots based on whether or not they were self-sustaining based on the income that they had.
Yeah,
that's exactly right. Which is why it got its name as the Orange Dot Project, I believe.
Yep, exactly. And two, I mean, Ridge is a force. I mean, he didn't stop there. You know, he had to get an assessment of what the problem was, but then that was all just part and parcel of trying to solve the problem. And so he then developed a very thorough and I think it's going to have a lot of effect in terms of solving a lot of that poverty.
You talked about income mobility. You had this in your article as well. A recent study on income mobility by Stanford and Harvard found that Charlottesville ranks near the bottom at 2,700 out of nearly 2,900 jurisdictions, meaning if you're born in Charlottesville, you are very likely to remain poor, that there are 2,699 other cities and counties where you're more likely to gain wealth. I read that so poorly. Over 93% of the others are more likely to gain wealth. Sorry, I read that incredibly poorly.
No, you did fine.
But that Charlottesville is a horrible city for income mobility. So if you're born poor, you're going to stay poor. Right. You need to move away.
And that's what a lot of people do, my generation included, you know, and that there isn't a lot of economic opportunity here. Unless you're born into a nice economic bracket, that you have some wealth behind you, generational wealth, family wealth. Yeah, it's hard.
You have a couple other quotes I want to read. These are only one sentence. I won't screw these up so bad. That who wants to work at UVA when they don't give you a sufficient raise? Because Charlottesville had nothing to offer other than working for UVA Hospital.
Right.
For African Americans, I believe is what the quote was referring to. So if you're at 10th and Page, if you're in Fifeville, that's really all that's offered.
That is, I mean, it's the largest employer in Charlottesville, right? And so they employ, I think, upwards of 28,000 people, not just at the hospital, but all throughout the university system, and the hospital being one of the major networks. And so where else do you go as far as industry? You can go into hospitality service, you can go into maybe NGIC if you have some sort of schooling and background.
NGIC.
Exactly, right, the National Ground Intelligence Center. And I'm trying to think of maybe the third largest employer. But in any case, yeah, your options are limited. And so as a result, you don't have but so many things that you can pursue. But that didn't just arise, right? We're not just coming to that scenario in a bubble again. It's predated by a whole variety of realities that produce that. And so, and part of that is African Americans being told by white people what they can and can't do for employment. And eventually, white people stopped doing that and stopped preventing African Americans from doing certain things. And so there was room to grow into some of those professions. But there is a very real kind of historical reality for why we only have singular African Americans in certain professions. Why do we have only one or two African American dentists? Why do we have only one or two licensed clinical social workers? Why do we have a handful of black realtors? These are all realities, and they're not proportionate to our demographics of our population.
Again, our guest today, Jordy Yeager, as we're talking about his article on gentrification in Charlottesville, especially at 10th and Page in the heart of the city. We'll be right back. And here we are back with Jordy. Jordy, I don't want to get away too far on the actual gentrification in 10th and Page and the home ownership. There's lots here to talk about in your article. By the way, how long did it take you to write the article? How much research and writing went into this?
It was, I would say, probably at least 6 or 7 months of just continuing. Mean, again, this is not every single day. As a freelancer, I juggle probably 6 or 7 stories at a time. And so this was one of them. But it was over. I mean, some of these interviews occurred back in June, and I think it came out in December.
Yeah. You talk about, we opened the show talking about how the neighborhood was turning over from lower income to, I guess, middle income. And one of the things you mentioned in the article is the change, how there are now fences instead of porches. Talk about that, please.
Sure. So historically, if you look at a lot of the houses in that neighborhood in 10th and Page, they have these front porches. They typically aren't raised off the ground too much. Sometimes they are, but every single house on a street has one for the most part. And this predates air conditioning, and so people would, during those hot summer days, would sit on their porches. And you would holler at your neighbor across the street or right next to you, and you would have conversations. And it was a social milieu it was part of the social fabric of the neighborhood. And so it was one of those things that might not be visible to people who don't have front porches. And one of the shifts that occurred over the last decade and a half or so, as homes began to be sold, and typically white developers bought those homes and then fixed them up or tore them down and rebuilt, that the porch aspect wasn't integral to the building's design, that space was sometimes substituted with an off-street parking spot, or sometimes it was built out to be maybe a garden and a little pathway. But as a result, I mean, air conditioning obviously played a role in it too, because people were able to be inside. But as a result, you saw this gradual shift of the culture from being out in the street, on the porches, in their front yards, talking to one another, interacting, engaging with each other, to being one of more isolation and seclusion. And the other thing that happened alongside of that was that a lot of fences were put up. And traditionally, fences are not unheard of in the neighborhood. And what Jeremy Kaplan actually described to me is that a lot of the fences that existed in the 40s and the 50s were from Sears and Roebuck. They're the metal chain link fences that are probably about 4 feet high, waist level. And the reason that you see so many of those is that Sears and Roebuck was one of the first department stores to actually lend lines of credit to African Americans. That up till now, up till that point, white department stores were for only white people. That they prevented African Americans from buying anything on lines of credit. And so that's why you see them scattered throughout the neighborhood. And so the fences that did exist there were see-through. They were not solid. They weren't for privacy sakes. Usually it was for keeping an animal and or children inside a yard to make, you know, make a line, a barrier between the street and the yard so that it remains safe. And so it's not that fences didn't exist. It's the type of fences that you see starting to go up now. And a lot of times they're pressure treated wood that's been not been painted right away and or ever, and or they're white fences. But these are wooden fences that are pretty solid to the eye. And so you can't see behind them. And one of the questions that, longtime residents, especially African Americans, are asking is, you know, kind of jokingly or facetiously, but a little bit of truth there, of course, is the fence built to keep you in or keep us out, as your neighbors? And so it's visually a demarcation, a separator, an isolator. And I think one of the things I learned is that, that wasn't necessarily the intention by the fence builders, right? They didn't build it to isolate themselves from their neighbors. And so this is something that in the void of communication, with a lack of communication, of verbal or even written communication between neighbors, that your physical changes to your property end up speaking volumes. That's what gets communicated to your neighbors, because and so that it's nothing that verbal communication couldn't solve.
I'm going to step outside of 10th and Page for a second, because I think this took place in Fifeville. But when you talk about saying something to your neighbors that you didn't mean to, I think in your article you mentioned something that happened in Fifeville. A neighbor who, again, through gentrification, bought another house for Airbnb purposes and wrote the description for it and put it up, and through that made a comment that upset the neighbors. Can you talk about that?
Sure. Yeah. No, you're right. The couple that did that actually lives full time in Fifeville, but the house that caused all of this is in 10th and Page.
Okay, great.
And so it's across the street from a longtime 10th and Page resident, and so they were Airbnb-ing that house because it was a second house, and. In the description, I'd have to go back and read it, but it basically described the neighborhood as one that was in the process of gentrification and that wasn't always pretty.
Okay, I think, said it didn't look great on the outside.
Yeah. But
they had fixed it up on the inside.
Right. And of course, we all see things how we see them, and so maybe to them that's how it appeared, but to people that have been there for generations, that was a little bit offensive, and quite a bit offensive. And so but when I brought that up to that couple, they were unaware that that's how it was received. They didn't, and certainly that wasn't their intent, to be affronting or offensive, but that they were apologetic. They said, "Oh, I see how that could be taken offensively," and I think set about to try to make some sort of peace with their neighbors for as a result. And so it's that sort of thing where I think you have just different kind of cultural norms and different ways of seeing the world based on how you were brought up, based on you know, where you were brought up, and based on your lack of knowledge around Charlottesville. I mean, I think most of us by now have heard of Vinegar Hill, but certainly I don't think very many people know about Gospel Hill. Certainly people don't know about Preston Heights. You know, I mean, these are parts of history that were just as much real as Vinegar Hill, or the fact that the city has seized, you know, multiple African-American neighborhoods through, you know, basically the equivalent of eminent domain. I don't think it is explicitly that legally, but in any case, so that history is largely unknown to a lot of residents that have lived here their entire lives, let alone people who move here for jobs or for school. And so Yeah, I don't know if it's a good place to try to expect people to go in eyes wide open when they move into a neighborhood. But, you know, it would be nice if we could do something around that about educating.
30 minutes after the hour with our guest today, Jordy Yeager, a journalist. And we're talking about his most recent article on gentrification in Charlottesville. Jordy, you mentioned people not knowing the history of Gospel Hill, while they probably know Vinegar Hill. Give us a short story about Gospel Hill. Give us our history lesson.
Sure, I won't begin to do it justice, but the bare bones of what Gospel Hill was is where the UVA hospital is, was called the New Hospital, and so it's again just south of West Main Street. And let's see, to the south, I think it was bordered by kind of, what is that, King Street? So that runs all the way down to Fifield Park, and then all the way up to kind of where the emergency room is now, is my understanding of where.
So somewhere near the kitchen restaurant?
Yeah, yes. The corner restaurant, is that the one on Cherry and what is that, Roosevelt Brown? It's basically so you know where the Uncommon big or where Tracks used to be.
Yeah.
So it's right in there.
Okay.
So that's Gospel Hill. And it used to be, I've heard anywhere from about 15 to 25 houses, and predominantly, if not all, African American. It was raised in the late 50s, early 60s by University City agreement to knock it down. And a lot of those homes were owned by African Americans and or were rented by African Americans. And so, again, is one of the affordable places in the city. It was near downtowns, near the university, even though they were prevented from going to the university for school. But it was a good neighborhood from people I've spoken with that lived there. But it's not part of our historical record. I think the Blue Ribbon Commission mentions it once or twice in their lengthy report when they studied memorial statues and the history of race in Charlottesville, that they did stumble on some anecdotes around it. But when looking for a Gospel Hill scholar, you will be hard pressed, and so you have to find people that live there. And so I found a couple who are still around and willing to talk about the experience. And it's definitely not alone. I mean, the other thing is that urban renewal, while it demolished Vinegar Hill, it also affected Garrett Street down south of Water Street in downtown. It also affected parts of Fifeville. And so again, trying to take a more holistic view of what some of these historical place, excuse me, historical parts of our city look like.
Jordy Yeager here with us today. So one of the things that I found is, you know, when they, in the 60s, when Vinegar Hill was raised, is that in your article, you say that whites blocked poverty from their neighborhood, so it ends up in mixed income, mainly Black 10th and Page. So I'm not going to say, is that correct, but talk about that.
Sure. I believe has to do with you referenced the public the creation of public housing in Charlottesville.
So all of West Haven
is that
what that references?
Exactly. So before West Haven was chosen as a site, what was on the table for the city to consider was whether to create public housing in general. And then the question became, of course, where do we put public housing? And in that initial discussion, there was a discussion about, okay, do we segregate public housing? Because remember, this is the 50s and 60s, and so segregation was still very much a status quo. And it was decided, based on research done by a local scholar, that there was going to be white public housing and Black public housing. But what happened was that Black public housing got created and the white public housing ended up in more of kind of a Section 8 voucher sort of system that we have today. It wasn't exactly that, but they got placed into different middle and upper income neighborhoods throughout Charlottesville instead of being in a concentrated housing development, which is what African Americans ended up having. And so, and what we know now, of course, is that concentrations of poverty tend to foster greater impediments and hurdles to getting out of poverty than if you were in, because the number one factor is your environment and what surrounds you. And so when looking at what mixed income neighborhoods could or couldn't do, that's part of the equation.
Here's something from the Weldon Cooper Center here in Charlottesville. In Charlottesville, from 2011 to 2015, the median household income for white families was just over $56,000. For African-American families, just over $32,000. It's a gap of $24,000. It's incredible.
It's pretty substantial, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it begs the question, why? You know, yeah, and I think that's kind of what the article is trying to dive into, is looking at what are the factors that make that reality possible. And I think it's a variety. It's not just what kind of job you have, but it's also what kind of jobs are available to you, what kind of education is available, what. And that's determined by how much wealth your family has accumulated, right? I mean, a lot of kids got sent to, in the 60s, got sent to college, either on GI Bill or, on a second mortgage on a house. Home ownership is the primary way of attaining wealth in America, aside from better paying jobs, which, again, if you're not getting promoted at work, you know, if there is no income mobility throughout your wage, that's very difficult as well.
One thing that you wrote about, again, we're talking with Jordy Yeager, his article about gentrification in Charlottesville, 10th and Page residents seeing a shift in the neighborhood. Whites in the neighborhoods are seeing lower crime in 10th and Page. Or is that because they're finally bringing the police to that area?
Well, I think police have been there for a long time. I mean, they were certainly there in the 90s when I was growing up in Charlottesville, and I think into the 80s as well. And so I don't know that it's a factor of the police suddenly arriving. I think that that there are a variety of factors going into that. One is that a lot of the African Americans that were in that neighborhood during that time have moved. And so that population has turned over. And they've moved because economic opportunities were not available here. And that's part of the reason why people deal drugs, is not because they enjoy it, but because economic opportunities aren't available in other more legitimate ways, or legally sustainable ways. And that's a large part of what brought violence into 10th and Page, and that's a large part of why police presence was there in 10th and Page. And so if you look at, you know, kind of that chain of events of police wouldn't be there unless there was crime. Crime wouldn't be there unless there was poverty. Poverty wouldn't be there unless there was a more profuse way of getting wealth or income, then you have to look at why. And again, you go back to these laws, and which we haven't touched on yet, but I think are really important. And that's what I'm devoting the course of the next 6 to 12 months of research on, is racial covenants, of how Charlottesville was able to prohibit black people from moving into certain neighborhoods. And by and large, neighborhoods used a clause in their housing deeds that said that nobody, you know, I'm paraphrasing, but to the extent of saying that nobody other than the Caucasian race shall live here or purchase this home. other than a servant or somebody that's enslaved. And those are still exist in the housing deeds because it's very hard to take out. They're not legally binding, of course. The Supreme Court decided a case in 1968 that prohibited them, but they, up until 68, they dictated where African Americans could and could not live, which then dictated how much wealth they could accumulate based on their home value. And so the city was not putting money into neighborhoods like 10th and Page to rehab its streets, to put in different facilities and maintain property surroundings, you know, the connectors, whether it's the lights or the utilities or whether it's the actual street services that contribute to appreciation of home value. And so as a result, you see traditional white neighborhoods accumulating in value. You see traditional black neighborhoods either stagnating or even depreciating to the point that it justifies urban renewal. It justifies raising a neighborhood among the white government. And so this was not by accident. This was not because of a failure to succeed as a human race, within this neighborhood. It was very much by design. These are policies and procedures that have been largely forgotten and or covered up. And so we need to try to remember these and to figure out where we're going to go from here.
Jordy Yeager, our guest today on Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. This is 94.7 WPVC. We shall return. And back in action, Rick Moore here with Jordy Yeager, talking about gentrification in Charlottesville. Jordy, I want to get back to this, but I also want to know, what do you, you made mention of something you're working on and upcoming. So tell me about that.
Sure, sure. So as you can probably guess, I think housing is incredibly important to all of our social welfare and economic welfare here in this area. And so I think there are some huge remaining gaps of knowledge for myself and for a lot of folks that we would all do well to have. And so I've been putting together a series of pieces, still very much in pitch form right now, but I've gotten commitments from Virginia Public Radio as well as Seaville to publish and broadcast should I get funding for it. We sought funding through ProPublica, which is an international independently endowed and funded investigative journalism project that started some decade or so ago and did not get it. We were up against 260 other submissions, and they only had 6 grants, and so we didn't get it. But we got all of the material and all of the makings of this great year-long project that really takes a thorough examination of all of the different facets of Charlottesville's housing history, but also looking forward. What are we talking about when we're talking about form-based code? Why is that important to change Euclidean code to form-based code? These are very kind of nuanced and heavily jargoned sort of terms, but what does that actually mean? When developers say that they have a hard time developing, what is the red tape process that they're getting frustrated with, and why aren't we incentivizing more affordable housing? What are the carrots and what are the sticks that we have in our arsenal? To really thoroughly examine that, not necessarily supporting or advocating for any particular route, but just to make knowledge as widely available as possible. So that's one facet. The other facet is, how did we get here? And I kind of touched on that with the racial covenants that I spoke of that dictated where African Americans could not live in the city from roughly around 1910 to 1968. They were in wide circulation in use. And so what myself and several others are doing are going through deed books and mapping these neighborhoods of where these racial covenants existed on a physical map. And once we get that baseline of what these neighborhoods look like in terms of racial covenants, to overlay that with, okay, here are the changing income demographics of that neighborhood, here are the changing racial demographics, as well as the zoning practices for those neighborhoods.
You know, you're always welcome here to talk about these things. So please keep that in mind as you work forward.
I certainly will. Thank you.
All right, again, Jordy Yeager here today. A journalist with many things lined up for the future as we discuss some of the articles, or the article he's most recently had published in Seaville Weekly. And you can go find it at c-ville.com. 10th and Page residents seeing shift in their neighborhood. So, Jordy, one of the things, do you think that Charlottesville's newest mayor, Nikia Walker, will work to have some of these regulations changed to help prevent maybe some gentrification.
I don't know. And I don't know that preventing gentrification is A, possible, or B, the answer. I don't know what the answer is in terms of how do we get a more equitable city, in terms of opportunity, in terms of being able to live here. I think that's what I'm eager to try to devote a lot of time to, is figuring out how and why things are unfolding the way they are. And so with regard to Nikia, I think that I think she's eager in trying to understand the problem, and she knows anecdotally. She knows this is the first time we've had a native-born Charlottesvillian on council in how long? I think it's like 15 years or maybe more.
It's been quite some time.
Yeah, it's been a while. And so that in and of itself, I think, is encouraging, because you have a different perspective as somebody who's grown up here. You know, that when somebody is talking about a school board cut, that you have children not only in the system, but you were in the city school board or in the city school system as well. And so you have a reality that you're able to then transfer into any sort of policy decisions. So I think anecdotally, I would imagine that she knows very much the reality that's taking place in a lot of these neighborhoods. But procedurally and zoning, you know, the things, all of the tools that are used to make these things a reality, I think, is what everyone is trying to wrap their head around to try to understand.
How about Airbnb usage?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think, you know, it's kind of like the advent of the internet. Everybody was in a rush to try to figure out how it worked and what to do with it, you know, how to monetize news, for instance, on the internet. It's the same sort of thing. Like, Airbnb is throwing a whole new dynamic into...
I mean, it's hard to just rent a house, much right. less whether or not the house that you in your neighborhood is being taken from you. It's hard to just rent a house anywhere in the county. Whether or not you want it to, you know, it's being taken from your specific neighborhood.
Right, right. It's true. And inadvertently, it turns your neighborhood into a hotel district, right? I mean, that every weekend or potentially even every night, that you have different people coming in. And they don't, I mean, depending on who they are, I shouldn't blanket that statement, but what is spurring them to care about your neighborhood, these people that are coming in to stay overnight? You know, I've used Airbnb in a city overseas, and, you know, I try to make sure that I'm respectful of the neighborhood and the neighbors, and hopefully people do that as well. But it does change the kind of the fabric of a neighborhood to have it always be transient, to have it always be in flux in one regard, and then have people live there year-round in the other regard. I think part of why people love to move to Charlottesville is that you do have a closeness, a close-knitness in your community. And now you're starting to see the city grow with such rapidity and such kind of sporadicness in terms of how it grows and where it grows, that I don't know where the neighborhood cultures and the neighborhood fabric are ending up. And I think Airbnb plays a huge part in that. And the city's trying to figure out how to regulate it, you know, in terms of fines, in terms of fees or restrictions.
And we were already dealing with the university student, you know, someone who didn't live here buying the house or for their child. I mean, it was one thing for a landlord to buy it, to own it and rent it to university students. And then there was the second set of someone, you had people who would come and buy a home while their child went here. And we had those sorts of landlords, and then sell it when their child finished the 3 years or 4 years. And now you have someone who buys it and rents it to people that they don't even know. It's an unusual set of circumstances. Something that I found really, it made me go, that's unbelievable. The Daily Progress reported that 3 of 4 convicted felonies from 1989 to 1991 were black. This led to the public defender in 1998 racially targeted crack cocaine sentencing lack of legal representation for people in poverty. The public defender in Charlottesville wasn't created until 1998.
I know, right? Yeah, yeah, I know. It's startling. And up until that point, it was, I think, it wasn't like a lottery system, but it was like a rotational system where a judge...
It's almost like the jury system.
Yeah, 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 exactly, exactly. But instead of just civilians serving on a jury, it's lawyers, right?
Right. And so you have lawyer said, oh, your turn, you have to give up your time to come over here.
And do you think they paid them a good wage to take those cases?
Right, or no. They wanted to spend much time dealing with it.
Right, exactly. Well, yeah, and so as a result, you get what you pay for, right? So there was a standard, very low, like they would definitely make more money in private practice. And so, but this was, as you say, like jury service, you're obligated to do it. And so, when looking at the conviction rates, I mean, that was how they made the argument to bring a public defender's office, is that using this private kind of jury-esque sort of lawyer system.
The city of Charlottesville did not have a public defender's office until 1998.
Yeah, yeah, and Jim Hinchley was the first one.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
And they based that on the fact that their convicted felony rate was 75% for black African-American individual. That's outrageous.
There are still some communities in Virginia that don't have public defender system, that don't fall under any public defender jurisdiction, and operate in this older fashion.
Well, if you want to tell me that, and I'm going to say something that somebody might get mad at, that super dump county, it's just so small and so dispersed and so large that I can understand. I mean, I can just wrap my head around that. You know, no money. So small, so large, I can eventually be convinced on it. But this is a city. And it's 1998.
Right, exactly.
It's not the city that still in the 1960s was segregating their school system.
Right.
Unbelievable.
No, it's true. And so what are the ramifications of that, right? I mean, and I think to a certain degree, you still have large elements of that system at play, in so much as you see wealthy individuals get charged with a crime, receive far less sentencing than somebody who's low income or low wealth, who cannot afford to hire a lawyer, and especially with the crack cocaine sentencing disparities, the 100-to-1. I mean, there are a lot of elements at play in that deliberately fix the outcome of a legal system in favor of one group and not another.
We've only got about 6 minutes left, so let's go out with some positive notes. I'd like to talk about Jeremy Kaplan and Eugene Williams, and then if we have time, I'd like you to talk about McKee Rowe.
Sure, sure. Well, I mean, Jeremy Kaplan is a longtime Charlottesvillian. Let's see, I think in the early 80s, he started buying 1 to 2 properties and really hasn't stopped in the 37 years since. And what he does is rent them at deeply affordable rates and in 10th and Page, solely in 10th and Page. And I think one more constant emerging criticism is, you know, why don't you sell the homes to African-American families? And then, you know, it allows them to gain wealth and appreciate value and that sort of thing. But what he learned is that if it's kind of like preserving natural national parks or something, that as soon as you forego your ownership of that property, you no longer control what somebody does with it, right? And so one thing that I think we're seeing is as white people move into 10th and Page, well, it takes black people to sell their homes, right? And so it's not just that white people are moving in and strong-arming African-Americans who have been there, that there are certain factors that prompt African-Americans to sell their homes.
You have this sentence in your article, longtime African-American residents are selling their homes willingly to young white buyers.
Exactly, exactly. And so then the question becomes why? And I think part of that is that there's a lack of a black middle class here, that there's a lack of professional opportunities for black people, but there's also a lack of kind of a black-supported culture that's really fully embraced citywide. There are definitely very, very prominent pockets of
black culture. Events like happened in August that make you decide to move.
For sure, for sure. And so part of that criticism, I think, is Jeremy has a very specific vision that he needs to maintain these deeply affordable rates for African Americans and for anybody. I mean, he doesn't have solely African American tenants, but for people who do not make $70,000 a year. And that if not for him, that who else is going to do it? What are your options? You got Section 8, you got public housing, and you have maybe a couple of landlords that are like him that preserve housing at deeply. You know, we're talking less than $600 for one bedroom, and there's not very much around here, and so people are having to move to Waynesboro or Crozet. Even I mean, Crozet is not affordable anymore, but you know, Lynchburg. I think one family commutes every day from Lynchburg that I met. Who grew up here, you know, they moved to different parts of the county. So I think what Jeremy Kaplan is doing is well received in that neighborhood from what I've heard. There's also, and I didn't mention this in the piece, but there's also the City of Promise, which I think their slogan is a cradle to college or cradle to career sort of program that works on deep relationships with children and in 10th and Page. That's their footprint of where they operate. And so that there are different prongs. It's not just affordable housing. It's not just education opportunities. It's not just access to better healthcare. It's not just, you know, college trajectory. It's all of these things playing roles together. But it's certainly not just going to be 10th and Page. I mean, the conversation is starting in Rose Hill neighborhood. The conversation is starting in different parts of the city, as we begin to feel the constraints of 10 square miles upon us and trying to figure out where do we grow? How do we grow?
So tell me real quick, we have less than 2 minutes left, the story about McKee Row.
Sure. McKee Row, as I understand it, was just south of what was for a long time known as Jackson Park. This McKee Row predates the statue of Stonewall Jackson. So McKee Row, for those to try to get a visual, it's one block north of Market Street. I believe it's East Jefferson Street, and a block south of the courthouse and what was at one point the city jail. And it was predominantly African-American residents. I believe it was owned by a white man, but rented to largely African-Americans. And then it was razed I'm forgetting my dates, but I think it was 1918, 1919, somewhere in there. And after it was razed, everybody was forced to move to different parts of Charlottesville. Several years later, the statue of Stonewall Jackson was commissioned and erected in that park so that people, as they went to and from the courthouse, were reminded of the Confederate cause and the Confederate general. This was part of a long string of white Charlottesville developers and government telling black people to move. So where Lane High School was, where the county office building is now, that was all an African-American neighborhood, and they were told to move. I know one family that actually grew up there. And so, again, this is a part of a longer history here.
Jordy Yeager, be on the lookout for his next article. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you, Rick.
You're one of my favorite guests.
Thank you. This is a pleasure.
All right. Next week, Harriet Kerr from International Rescue Committee. Take care.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake-Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Production assistance and engineering from Sean McCord and Mike Friend. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for the Wake-Up Call, only on WPVC-LP Charlottesville.